loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, we'll talk about yesterday's primary elections. We'll go over election results from last night and today, including Ohio, Missouri, Michigan, Vermont, and more. Then we take a look at Canadian relations with Saudi Arabia. They worsened precipitously over the past week after Canada's foreign ministry tweeted concern for Saudi civil rights activists. Saudi leaders jumped on the issue, expelling the Canadian ambassador, withdrawing all 15,000 Saudi students from Canada, forbidding Saudi nationals from seeking medical treatment there, and ending direct flights between the two countries. And then it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. Today, we're focusing on two important anniversaries, the destruction, the bombing, the first use of atomic weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945.
But before we get to those three stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Senate Intelligence Committee has invited Julian Assange to meet with its professional staff members behind closed doors to discuss alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. The formal invitation was signed by both committee chairman Richard Burr and vice chairman Mark Warner. There's no indication that the committee will provide Assange with any guarantees for his safety if he chooses to accept the invitation. Next, there are several new developments in Russiagate. It's day seven of the Paul Manafort trial. Rudy Giuliani and Trump's personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow, just announced that they will not have Donald Trump sit for an interview with Robert Mueller. And the Trump administration announced new sanctions against Russia based on a finding that the Russian government is, in fact, responsible for the poisonings of defecting double agent Skripal. Then the Chinese Commerce Ministry slapped another 25% tariff on $16 billion of U.S. goods, including automobiles and motorcycles. This comes in the wake of the U.S. Trade Representative's decision to place 25% tariffs on $16 billion of Chinese goods. And then the European Union is sending a message to Iran. That message is that the Europeans are serious about salvaging the Iran nuclear deal. An aide to the EU's foreign policy chief said yesterday that European firms that stop doing business with Iran will in turn be sanctioned by the EU. And finally, National Security Advisor John Bolton said yesterday that the administration is, quote, still waiting, unquote, for North Korea to begin the denuclearization process. He added that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants a second summit with President Trump, but that is unlikely, absent real progress on the North Korean weapons and nuclear programs. And in other headlines, Senator Rand Paul has delivered a letter from President Donald Trump to Russian President Vladimir Putin, although there are conflicting reports about its contents. Senator Paul says that the letter, quote, emphasized the importance of further engagement in various areas, including countering terrorism, enhancing legislative dialogue, and resuming cultural exchanges, unquote. However, a White House official downplayed the importance of the letter, saying that it was just a letter of introduction. Republican Representative Chris Collins of New York was charged with federal crimes today related to insider trading. He's alleged to have fraudulently saved $768,000 by selling stocks of a pharmaceutical company where he served on the board of directors before news of a failed drug trial was released. Collins is among the wealthiest members of the House of Representatives and was the first member of Congress to endorse Donald Trump for president. Argentina's Senate has begun debate on a measure to legalize abortion within 14 weeks of conception. The measure previously passed the country's lower house but faces an uphill battle in the Senate. Women's rights organizations have led large mobilizations in support of the law, but right-wing groups and the Catholic Church have mounted a counteroffensive. A new United Nations study estimated that the financial cost of the war in Syria has reached $388 billion. The report was issued by the Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia. The more than seven-year-long effort to overthrow the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad has also led to 500,000 deaths by some estimates. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to yesterday's primary elections. Yesterday was primary election day in states across the country, and the early results indicate that nobody yet has a clear idea of what's happening. In a hotly contested congressional race in Ohio, for example, the Republican leads the Democrat by less than 0.5%, which triggers an immediate recount. Moderate Democrats defeated their more progressive challengers in a half a dozen House races. And firebrand conservative Kris Kobach is leading incumbent Republican Kansas Governor Jeff Collier by fewer than 200 votes. We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James. She worked on Rashida Tlaib's congressional campaign, and she's one of the litigators in the lawsuits against the city of Flint regarding its polluted water. And we're also joined from New Orleans by Aurelia Williams. She is a student activist and organizer. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Julie, let's start with you. This was an historic race that you were involved in with Rashida Tlaib. She's the first Palestinian American voted through the primaries. She's obviously the first Palestinian American woman. She's in a Democratic district, so she's going to win the general election.
In all likelihood.
In all likelihood. So tell us a little bit about the kind of race she ran, how she won this primary, and what this means for Michigan.
Well, Rashida is she's an unbelievable organizer. And it's not only that she's Palestinian, but that she's an open member of the Muslim faith. And she is very proud of that, and she doesn't hide it or try to sidestep it. And that's what makes her victory in this race so significant. She is someone, however, who focuses on the broader progressive agenda to confront the right-wing trajectory that this country is on. So she ran a campaign that was based almost exclusively on boots on the ground, individual contact with the constituents who she was trying to recruit and get votes from. She visited 50,000 homes during the course of her campaign, and it was through her individual personal contact with the community and with these constituents that she was able to make a solid human connection with them, so that her message really resonated with this community, regardless of race or ethnicity or demographic or geography. The message that she has is one that is is the same message that someone, for example, like Bernie Sanders had. The reason he was so effective and powerful in his campaign are all very similar reasons why Rashida was able to win the day here in Michigan. And she is a fighter. She will not back down. She's a fierce advocate. She was arrested at a Trump speech in Detroit back in right after his inauguration. He came to Michigan to speak to the Economic Club. She went to that event, and she got up and loudly and vigorously confronted him in front of the whole world and got escorted out of that event and arrested because she's someone who is not afraid to confront the evil that is going on in this country right now.
Aurelia, let me ask you, what are your takeaways from the elections around the country yesterday?
Well, I think it's very interesting that Republicans still have quite a suburban problem. In 2016, we saw a huge surge in the Republican rural vote. But as we see in, for example, some of the primaries in Virginia, there's still a bit of a problem in the suburban vote. I was very surprised also by Michigan, where we see an interesting split, where we do have Rashida Tlaib, but we also have Gretchen Whitmer. So it's pretty interesting how some of these 11th hour votes, I think, come through, and we see a bit of a whiplash in places where Bernie was giving nominations. I think that people see that as a sign that Bernie and his, quote unquote, army are losing. But I tend to disagree. I think that Bernie still has a lot of pull and that his endorsements do matter, which is why we saw such a surge in kind of some of these 11th hour voters. I think it's directly in response to Ms. Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Sanders endorsing people.
I want to ask both of you, too, And Julie, let's start with you. What do the results of yesterday mean for this blue wave that everybody's talking about? Do you think that we're looking at something like a blue wave?
I think we're looking at the potential for a blue wave, if you want to call it a blue wave. I mean, I have a hard time identifying with the Democratic Party mainstream, but I do believe that thanks to the voice that Trump has given to the extremist right-wing racist agenda that he really stands for, and the extent to which they are willing to put themselves out there as blatantly as they are, the left and the progressive response to that is mobilized, and is mobilized in a much more powerful way, and that the message of a more progressive, might I say, socialist perspective is gaining a tremendous amount of ground that creates, I think, the possibility, you know, as things become more and more frightening and more dangerous for us as a democracy in this country, I think that the more progressive perspective is gaining much more credibility. And we saw in Michigan, for example, a historic number of votes were cast in yesterday's primary, way higher than it's been in decades. And I think that's because people are willing to, you know, they're opening their eyes finally. Whether it's too little, too late remains to be seen.
You know, let me ask Aurelia actually about that point. Michigan was actually fascinating yesterday, to me more interesting than any other state for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's such a Republican state. Donald Trump won by such a wide margin there 2 years ago. But yesterday, voters took a decidedly pro-labor stand statewide in one issue, and then they threw out the Ferguson prosecutor in another race. So what do you make of that, especially coming in a state like Missouri?
I think it shows the changing of the tide. You know, there are a lot more labor voters in Michigan because as we see a return to jobs in Michigan, it becomes something very important to vote on again. And so I think we see people kind of putting their faith into people that they think will make effective change. Because as we see in response to Trump, we see a lot of people finally beginning to vote as if this is going to affect their direct future. So I think that's why we see such interesting breakdowns, particularly in places like Michigan, because I think one of the reasons they were able to throw out the Ferguson prosecutors because people are seeing that whatever we've got going on right now isn't working. I think that's why we also have an increase in diversity of candidates. As we saw in Kansas, Sharice Davids, who's one of the first Native American women who might be elected to Congress coming out of Kansas. So I think it's just indicative of the fact that people are really tired of the way that things are currently being run, and be it a blue wave or just an increase in diversity of candidates, because we saw a lot more women running as well. Things have got to change. And I think people are finally investing their vote in that.
Julie, there was a real diversity of candidates this time, probably more so than ever before. But then at the same time, by the end of the day, most of the candidates that won were sort of mainstream, moderate, neoliberal Democrats. What do you make of that?
The power of the Democratic machine in Michigan, it's pretty forceful. And I think the unique nature of the Rashida Tlaib campaign was that there really was no Democratic machine candidate in the mix. It was that they were the two top contenders were the Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones, who has a history of union activism, and she's not, you know, she's an African American liberal politician who doesn't really, she has somewhat of a machine behind her, but not anything like the, for example, Gretchen Whitmer, and her defeat of Abdul El Sayed, which was a great disappointment to many of us, but she had a powerful machine behind her. And so I think that has something to do with the outcome.
Right. Really, the most watched race, I think, in the country yesterday was this congressional race in Ohio. It was a special election. So the winner is only going to fill the seat until November, and there's going to be another race. Well, between the two candidates, they spent something like $6 or $6.5 million just to be a congressman for the next 3 months. This is a district that Donald Trump won with 68% of the vote. And so far, yesterday, we know that that it's 50.2 to 49.7. So it's so close that it demands an automatic recount. Is this a fluke? Is this a continuation of what we saw in southwestern Pennsylvania? And is this something that you think is going to carry on around the country?
Yeah, I don't think this is a fluke. And I think partly it is attributed to the Democratic machine. I think as it was in Pennsylvania, it is a continuation. The response in Ohio was a direct response to how many Trump supporters and how much money was poured into that election. I think that particularly because it was a special election, even though it's only going to last for 3 months, I think the Democrats are showing that they're willing to go tit for tat in the particular places that do matter, because I think that they're gearing up not only for a pretty intense kind of reclamation coming up with the midterms, but also I think they're gearing up for 2020.
I think you're right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She's a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, who worked on Rashida Tlaib's congressional campaign. And she's one of the litigators in the lawsuits against the city of Flint, Michigan, regarding its polluted water. We were also joined from New Orleans by Aurelia Williams. Aurelia is a student activist and an organizer. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Canadian relations with Saudi Arabia worsened precipitously over the past week after Canada's foreign ministry tweeted concern for Saudi civil rights activists. Saudi leaders jumped on the issue, expelling the Canadian ambassador, withdrawing all Saudi students from Canada, forbidding Saudi nationals from seeking medical treatment there, and ending direct flights between the two countries. How bad is that going to get for Saudi-Canadian relations? We're joined from Toronto by attorney Christopher Black. Christopher is an international criminal attorney who has worked on high-profile cases involving war crimes and human rights. Chris Black, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
The Canadian government did the unspeakable.
Yeah.
It mildly criticized the Saudi royal family. Go ahead.
Right. It's hard to know why they did it, because Canada has not really a great human rights record itself, and it's hypocritical to criticize others. But in any event, setting that aside, why they openly criticize the Saudis in this way and demanded the immediate release of these people, which got out the nose of the Saudi, Mr. Bin Salman, I think. So, I mean, they could have done this by a discreet message through the ambassadors and exerted pressure that way, but to do it this openly seems to have really gotten to the Saudis. But what's behind it may be friction developing over the last couple of years about the big arms deal that was made between Canada and Saudi Arabia. For $15 billion, they were selling armored cars to Saudi Arabia. And it was meant, the deal was that it was to be kept secret. But I think when Trudeau came to power a couple of years ago, details were leaked about what was going on. And then stories about these armored cars being used to attack the people in Yemen and crush internal dissent and so on. So it caused the Saudis a lot of problems and really angered them, and they felt they were being betrayed. Like Canada was taking their money, but making them look bad at the same time. So there's been a lot of friction building over that, and this may have just been one straw too many for them.
Had you seen that, John?
I had not seen that, actually. And that's why I've been so surprised at the Saudi reaction to these tweets. The Saudis have gone completely overboard in their reaction, and I wondered what the genesis of this was, because this reaction has been so severe.
And it's also interesting what Chris Black is saying. You know, the Saudis could, I mean, we're not, obviously, we're big critics of the Saudi royal family, but if the Canadian ruling elites are selling them all these weapons, which is a form of subsidy for Canada's own arms industry, $15 billion in weapons, and then the Canadian authorities decide to tweet rather than talk privately with the Saudis about their obvious violations of people's human rights, the Saudis will think of this as an unnecessary, gratuitous way of the two countries talking to each other. Anyway, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, it's just a slap in the face as far as they see it. So I think that may be what's led to this moment, because I mean, I think the Saudis had in 2015 recalled their ambassador from Sweden and the same from Germany in 2017 over similar complaints about criticism of their government's policies, but they never went this far of canceling all trade and everything else going on.
Yeah, let me interrupt you for 1 second on that, Chris. I don't know if our listeners really appreciate the depth of this fight, and it's just been a few days, but the Saudis have canceled trade. I mean, it's remarkable. Right. They've canceled trade with Canada. They've banned Canada Air flights into Saudi Arabia, and they've suspended their own Saudia flights into Canada. Right. There was a tweet today from the Globe and Mail that says Saudi Arabia has instructed their overseas asset managers to dispose of all Canadian equities, bonds, and cash holdings, no matter the cost. And more than that, if you're a Saudi national, you're not even allowed to get medical treatment in Canada. You have to be evacuated and sent to another country for medical care. That was today's little addition.
And there are 15,000 Saudi students which now have to leave.
They have all 15,000 have to leave and go to universities in other countries.
So yeah, it's going to be complete disruption for them. So yeah, so it's a pretty, I mean, it's not a major economic impact on Canada really,
because
it's not much. But still, it's a very drastic. It is a very drastic reaction, and it's a very sharp slap in the face to Canada. And the other problem for Canada is that it's been supporting Saudi Arabia in its attacks on Yemen by supplying these arms. It never criticizes what the Saudis are doing to the Yemenis, to the Yemen people. They don't criticize what they're doing to the other people in Saudi Arabia. They don't criticize what they're doing supporting the White Helmets, which Canada also supports and is taking in.
That's Syria.
No, so why? Yeah. So the Saudi can say, why are you slapping us for these two people? And so openly, I mean, we're brothers in arms. We're violating human rights everywhere. Why are you criticizing us? So I think they got their nose out of joint. But why Canada did it, that's an interesting question for me. Why Freeland made this blunder, because I think it looks like a blunder to me, is that it was so much criticism for the Canadian government from human rights groups and peace groups that they were selling these weapons to Saudi Arabia. It was giving them a very dirty name. So this may have been a way of trying to mollify that crowd of people clamoring for human rights in Saudi Arabia and with stopping the arms sales. So it was like to mollify them. We'll critique the same people we're selling the arms to, but it seems to have backfired.
Yeah, it does seem to have backfired. I think that nobody expected the Saudi reaction to be as strong as it's been. And just judging by previous incidents, similar but not the same as this, because I don't think anything has been so severe. It's going to take years for the Saudis and the Canadians to get back to a normal state of relations after this.
Maybe, because I saw the Saudi Justice Minister Jabir today saying, we can resolve this. Canadians know what they have to do, which means a complete abject apology, which they're not going to do.
No.
The United States is staying neutral. They're saying it's not between them. That they're actually supporting Saudi Arabia's position in a way. And Russia came out with direct support to Saudi Arabia, saying Canada should keep its nose out of other people's business. That's all it does. may be surprising that Russia did that, but they're subject to the same criticism from Canada all the time, so it's tit for tat. But Canada, I think, boxed itself in, and it's going to have problems now. Mm-hmm. And Saudis are threatening more economic damage. I'm not sure what. They haven't said yet. But
okay, so they... Anyway, let's reintroduce our guest, John. It's Christopher Black. Christopher Black is an attorney. Do you call yourself an attorney in Canada, or are you a barrister?
Yeah, I'm a barrister. Well, I just say lawyer.
Okay. Okay, we're going to leave it with lawyer, since we have an audience in both countries. Christopher Black is an international criminal attorney. He's worked on very high-profile cases, war crimes cases, cases at the special tribunals, are you on the list at the Hague?
Yes, I'm on the International Criminal Court Council list. Yes.
And when I, just for our audience, that doesn't mean you're going to the, you're not wanted by The Hague. You're an attorney going and representing
people.
Yeah,
I'm on the council list. So if an accused wanted to have a lawyer, they can choose me. But I doubt they'll ever show any prisoner my name.
Yes, indeed.
But I'm on the list, yes. I'm part of it.
So let's understand why the Canadian foreign minister did this. Chris Black, John, is saying this was perhaps a howling blunder tactically.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we don't know, or I certainly don't know much about Canadian politics. Was it because he was individually sort of lobbied by Saudi human rights activists and impacted? Was it that he was trying to...
Well, there really aren't that many Saudi human rights activists outside of London. They all congregate in London. They always have. There aren't many in the United States, a handful. There aren't any in Canada of any note.
Is that true, Chris?
Yeah, they're not very active here. I think most of the criticism to the government was about the arms deal came from peace groups and the NDP and other parties who wanted to just give trouble to the ruling party.
Is the foreign minister, quote, more liberal? Is that what happened?
She's a member of the Liberal Party, although she's supporting Nazis in the Ukraine, so that's their shtick.
Well, it's... But there's a lot... So, you mean you can be more liberal about Saudi Arabia and still support Nazis in the Ukraine?
Well, that's the hypocrisy of this Freeland. Her grandfather was a Nazi collaborator in the Western
Ukraine. Coming full circle here.
A Nazi newspaper, but she denied that, and she's... The Canadian government supplying the Azov Battalion and other militia, right-wing militias, Nazi militias in Ukraine with weapons and the Ukrainian regime with weapons to attack the Donbass republics.
Is Justin Trudeau going to be unhappy or express unhappiness with the tweet of the foreign minister?
No, they seem to have some sort of special relationship. I mean, she was promoted up from lower rank ministries, and she's not the most diplomatic person in the world and rubs noses the wrong way, and she's very smug. So she's not that popular, but he seems to like her for some reason. She's got connections with people in the United States and power brokers in Britain. It's all sorts of a web of tangled web of connections, but I don't think he'll openly criticize her. He'll probably support her. And they'll maintain their position that we have the right, we want to support, we're supporting Canadian values. You know, nobody knows what that really means. Just but we'll be...
I think it's freedom and justice.
Yes. Right.
So Chris Black is our guest. Chris, we have 2 minutes left. Real quick, do you think the Saudis are taking such harsh measures against Canada because they're actually, or at least partly because they're actually extremely concerned about how the outside world perceives the Saudi royal family? I mean, it is by its existence the actual negation of any notion of freedom or justice. I mean, they must be very, very sensitive. Of course, the Saudi monarchy, like the earlier Iranian monarchy, can be isolated internationally. It can also be toppled by democratic revolution from below.
Right. Well, this move seems to be supported by conservative elements in Saudi Arabia. Nationalists like it. They're saluting this move. And it pleases... I mean, Bin Salman has been trying to move towards more liberal policies vis-a-vis women in Saudi Arabia, letting them drive now, and things like conservative elements don't like that. So this may be a way of mollifying them from his side.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. What happens to the 15,000 Saudi students? I mean, do they have to leave immediately?
That's not sorted out yet. I just the news is flying too fast to figure out the details of how that's all going to work.
In our last 30 seconds, you're in Toronto. Is this a big media story in Canada?
Yes, it is. It's all over every newspaper carries it, and nobody seems to understand it.
Yeah. Do Canadians, I know you can't talk about Canadians as a one thing, but I'll ask you anyway, do Canadians feel good that their government is standing up to the Saudi monarchy or try to?
I would say a lot of them are supporting it because they've been taught that this country really is what it claims to be, not what it really is, which is another imperial power. But they really believe all this stuff. And therefore, there'll be great support in some left-wing liberal groups that they've stood up to the Saudis because the Saudis are really cramped, you know, attacking the Yemenis, and they're doing all these other things, which are very bad, and they don't treat people well.
Yeah.
So they have reason. but they won't see the other side of the story. They won't see what's, they won't dig deeper into what's really going on in the dynamics of the situation. So,
okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Toronto, Canada, by Christopher Black. Christopher is an attorney, a lawyer. He is an international criminal lawyer who's on the list of counsel before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and he's worked on high-profile cases involving war crimes and human rights. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. In addition to listening to this program, get involved. Go to Kevin Camp's website, beyondnuclear.org, and learn about what they're doing, what they're saying, and most importantly, what you can do to get involved. Kevin Camps, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Well, we had, of course, August 6th is the anniversary of the use of the first nuclear weapon against human beings, and that was at Hiroshima, 1945. And days later, another devastating second nuclear bomb against the people, the civilian population center in Nagasaki, Japan, thus opening the nuclear era, which of course isn't just about nuclear weapons because the entire nuclear architecture, edifice, structure in energy also arose from that same point. I mean, gosh, when you think about it, What's the big takeaway? Nagasaki. Talk about that.
Yeah, the number of deaths and injuries are mind-boggling. 140,000 deaths in Hiroshima, a city of like 360,000. And then Nagasaki, because the bomb didn't hit downtown exactly because there was cloud cover that interfered with the targeting, another 70,000 killed at Nagasaki. So, yeah, what a announcement of the atomic age that that was. And at first, the American people were filled with joy and relief that the war was over, you know, not long after the Nagasaki bomb. But as a book called By the Bomb's Early Light by Boyer explained, that joy quickly gave way to fear because the American people even realized within weeks, really, if not days, that if we can do that to somebody else, somebody else can do that to us. And sure enough, Russia had the bomb within 4 years.
I mean, I think the basic narrative, certainly when I was growing up, was I thought there was still, not if not a consensus, a very, very, very strong majority opinion that thought Japan started the war. We ended the war. We did it with a nuclear bomb. A lot of Japanese died, but fewer Americans died. Thus, it was justified.
And you remember the narrative, too, that the war would have dragged on and more soldiers would have been killed. So this actually saved lives. I heard that for years.
Yeah. And I'd say, at least when I grew up, most of the people I went to school with, when I can remember, like in social studies class, I mean, I didn't really have enough knowledge to challenge it, but it didn't seem right to me. But I think most of my fellow students did agree with
that. Oh, yeah. I think most Americans believe that.
Well, we're still battling myths. And Gar Alperovitz, in his 1995 book, The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb, really put a lot of this to rest, in my mind, for sure. So the actual U.S. government estimates at the time, looking at what kind of casualties will we suffer if we invade mainland Japan? Their estimate at the time before the bombs were dropped was 50,000, which is nothing to downplay, 50,000 American lives at risk. Not a million, though. And the myth became a million lives, a million American lives were saved by dropping the bombs. That was not true. And some of the quotes in Alperovitz's book were from Eisenhower and Leahy, the top military commanders of the U.S. military, who said they were not trained to fight war this way against essentially women and children and old people. That's about 90% of who were in Hiroshima that day. And Leahy pointed out that the blockade on Japan, the Navy blockade, was complete, and the same can be said of the air blockade on Japan. They were defeated, and those bombs were dropped. The truth is, the bombs were dropped to send a message to the Soviet Union where to get off. And also, another aspect is that billions of dollars in 1945 money had been spent on this project, and so the bombs were dropped to fulfill an experiment as well, to show some return on this so-called investment. And a question I've had that I've never really heard an answer to is, if those billions of dollars had been spent on ships and tanks and guns in the U.S. military instead of atomic bombs, would the war have ended sooner through that? And that's a real question.
And the other part of this equation that's not really discussed, but it's important, and it's hard for Americans to wrap their head around this, but I want to give it a shot, is the Soviet Union had at long last finally opened up or declared war on Japan and opened the Eastern Front. That was at the same time. I think that was August 8th. I think that was today, 1945. August 7th was Hiroshima. August 8th, the Soviets declared war on Japan, which the U.S. had been urging the Soviet Union to declare war on Japan. And also, Peter Kuznick, the historian, has made the point that once they knew, and they certainly knew by then that it was a lost cause, that the Japanese ruling elites would have much preferred to surrender to the United States than to the Soviet Union, where the Soviet Union was going to probably nationalize their property, expropriate them, have a communist-led government, and thus they could see an even greater danger to their own fortunes than, say, if they surrendered to the United States. Surrender was going to happen to somebody.
Yeah, August 6th, Hiroshima, the Soviets launched their Asian invasion, joining the war effort against the Japanese. August 9th is Nagasaki. There's another amazing book by Paul Hamm, an Australian writer, called Hiroshima, Nagasaki, where somehow he got access to the Japanese war cabinet deliberations, the documentation. And you're exactly right what you described from Kuznick's hypothesis. The Japanese war cabinet, which had a peace element, which we should talk more about, but they were very secretive about it because if it came out that they were suing for peace, they would be assassinated by the military imperialists on the Japanese war cabinet. And so there was a lot of truth that the Japanese decision makers realized that if the Soviets invaded mainland Japan, they would never leave. But the Americans, although they would stay for a while, they would eventually leave.
But they are, in fact, still there.
Well, and, you know, there's another myth that the bombs ended World War II. And actually, no, it was the threat of a Soviet military invasion that ended World War II. The bombs, I mean, the Japanese have been firebombed at will by the Americans for months already. And there were very few targets left that hadn't been firebombed. And that lends a lot more credibility to the theory that these atomic bombings were tests, because they were saving some cities to use this bomb against, and they wanted to see full on what the effects were. And so Hiroshima had been preserved for that purpose.
Yeah, it was a laboratory. They were going to not firebomb Hiroshima, not firebomb Nagasaki, so they'd have a clean sort of slate.
Jeez, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I never heard that before, but that makes complete sense.
Actually, Dr. Arjun Makajani at Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, as is his pattern, he found some primary documents where the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, Department of Energy, actually had a listing of U.S. nuclear weapons tests. I emphasize the word tests. Trinity, New Mexico, July 16th, 1945. Hiroshima, Japan, August 6th, 1945. Nagasaki, Japan, August 9th, 1945. And when this was protested and called to their attention, they removed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But truth be told, those were tests.
It was a test, of course. And as you said, it was, you know, if the U.S. had a monopoly on this devastating weapon, one bomb can wipe out a whole city. And of course, those are tiny nuclear bombs compared to what we have now. But it seemed like, okay, that's going to be the arbiter of the next phase of human history. We have a weapon that's unmatchable, and they didn't anticipate the Soviets would quickly get the nuclear a nuclear arsenal to create parity or to have a deterrent impact. So that's a big card that you have. That's four aces in your hand, right? That was the thinking. And so what really was happening was the inauguration not only of a new nuclear age, but a new era in global politics. Before World War II, the dominant empire in world politics, there were several, but the dominant one was the British Empire. But that was ending. World War II, I mean, World War I was already the precursor and showed the fraying of the British Empire as the leading power in the world. And certainly by World War II, all of the other major powers had been devastated by the war, physically devastated, their cities devastated, their factories devastated, their people devastated, their colonial possessions from which they derived so much wealth. Those colonial possessions, meaning people who lived in colonies, were starting to rise up as a consequence. The U.S. was stepping into the void, creating the new, what they thought would be unipolar world with this unipolar weapon that nobody else had. That's the truth. I mean, I think that's the truth, but I guess, you know, they just interviewed the last surviving pilot from the, I think the Enola Gay, or maybe the guy who dropped the bomb on Nagasaki.
Actually, his plane was called Necessary Evil, if you can believe that.
Necessary Evil. So they just interviewed him and they said, do you have any regrets? And he said, no, the Japanese started it. We ended it. We saved a lot of American lives. No regrets. I mean, once you come to that position, then you don't have to think about the fact that, oh my God, I just personally contributed to the incineration of like 90,000 people or some.
The main pilot on the Enola Gay, which is still on display, shamefully, at the Smithsonian's Dulles Museum. And I was attendee at Peter Kuznick's 2003 shadow conference that protested this re-unveiling of the Enola Gay back then. And it was powerful because Hibakusha, survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, attended. There was a big protest. Many hundreds of people protested. There was even, in the plowshares tradition, blood thrown on the Enola Gay. And what's really shameful about this display is there's a little sign that says, this plane ended World War II with the dropping of an atomic bomb in Hiroshima, Japan. And that's the entire information that's given. And we've talked about the myths. And why that went down that way is because when the Enola Gay was going to be displayed downtown at the Smithsonian, there was a huge battle between veterans for foreign wars who didn't want any of, you know, this other perspective on Hiroshima to come out. They just wanted the myths and the glorification. And so they dumbed it down, but it's still kind of presented as a glorious thing at this museum. And so the Hibakusha, I was standing with one woman who was a survivor of Hiroshima, and now she was an elderly woman. This was back in 2003. She was a kid at the time. And she described how she saw the plane approaching the city and thought it odd because it was just one plane. It didn't have a whole squadron of B-52 bombers, B-29 bombers like they usually used for firebombing. It was a small number of planes. The Necessary Evil was one of the escort planes. And a single bomb was dropped, and she even saw it. She saw the bomb come out of the bomb bay door. And this was the second time she'd seen the plane in 2003 now. And she was physically shaking. She was so upset. And no wonder. I mean, it killed so many of her family and friends.
There's something called the, I may be mispronouncing it, but the Kokura effect. Kokura, I believe, was the city that was supposed to be bombed tomorrow on the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. I'm going to read a little bit back from some of the history on this. Back to August 9th, the boxcar was flying over Kokura, but it was impossible to visually see the target because of clouds and smoke coming from an earlier firebombing in the neighboring city of Yahada. So they moved to their secondary target, which was Nagasaki. So just imagine, you're bombed in Nagasaki, basically a civilian population center, not because of something you've done, not because your city is decisive. You're a test for this new weapon. And you just happen to get chosen because the other primary target just happened to have too much smoke and clouds that day.
Another irony about Nagasaki was and is that it is the primary Christian city in Japan. Christians had missions in Nagasaki for a long time at that point. There was a cathedral in Nagasaki. And ironically enough, because the cathedral was one of, or maybe even the biggest building in Nagasaki, it was used to target the city with the atomic bomb. And to make it even worse, the boxcar plane that dropped the bomb and its crew were blessed by a Christian priest before the mission.
It's like what happened during Vietnam when they used to, you know, you'd have priests out on the tarmac blessing the planes before they took off and carpet bombed Vietnamese villages.
Or during the dirty war in Argentina, where priests would be on the plane giving people last rites before shoving them out of the side of the plane into the ocean.
Yeah. When you're talking about the dirty war, you're talking about the Falklands?
No, the dirty war where the military took over and murdered so many Argentine
civilians.
Oh,
in the 1974, 75, yes. Yeah. Against the progressive left mm-hmm. forces, yeah. Let's go forward. I mean, we're talking to Greg Mello the other day because it was the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. And I asked him what I've asked you several times, which is how much have we actually spent on nuclear weapons since this time, 73 years ago. And Greg Mello said, that's a number I should know, meaning he doesn't know it exactly, but he estimates $10 trillion. $10 trillion. And then we were doing some arithmetic games trying to figure out what is a trillion, what is 10 trillion, what is it, you know, what do you get for that kind of money? It's a staggering number.
Well, yeah, I think that's about in the ballpark. There's a book from 1996 called The Atomic Audit. And again, Arjun Makajani was one of the co-authors, and its estimate at the time was $7.5 trillion spent on the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. So you have to add to it since. You have to adjust for inflation. And that's about half our national debt right there. That's another way of looking at it. And now we have this plan that unfortunately has been somewhat bipartisan, although Trump is going forward in a big way, and that is to renovate, modernize our nuclear weapons arsenal to the tune of, if you again adjust for inflation, $1.7 trillion. So we're about to add another 10% onto that grand sum that we are talking about.
I read Michio Kaku's book, To Win a Nuclear War, a book that's, it's probably out of print now, but I really was impressed with the book. I was doing a lot of work at the time around Korea, and the book opens very dramatically with a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that was, I think, in May 1953. And a decision was taken, a unanimous decision by all the chiefs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon to begin, I think it's called Operation Boilerplate or Broilerplate. I can't remember. But it was to start dropping nuclear bombs all over North Korea and China, unless the North Koreans and the Chinese signed an armistice. I guess the Pentagon had come to the conclusion winning the Korean War was no longer possible, and they wanted to finally end it after having failed to conquer North Korea. So the North Koreans didn't want to sign. They wanted to keep fighting, apparently. Anyway, talk about that, if you would.
It reminds me of a book by Joe Gershon of the American Friends Service Committee, Empire and the Bomb, I believe is the title, or maybe it's Empire of the Bomb. And what he did is he documented all known threats or uses, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but threats to use nuclear weapons. And so what you've just described was really the heart of the book, which was mostly United States threats against other countries, sometimes Soviet threats against other countries to use atomic weapons. And it's that, you know, metaphor of you have a handgun, it is loaded, and you use it to rob a bank. Did you use the gun? Absolutely, you used the gun. You didn't pull the trigger. And it's the same with nuclear weapons. If you threaten to destroy a country to get something, you're using a nuclear weapon. And back in the mid-1990s, the International Court of Justice, which is a United Nations agency in the Netherlands, ruled that threatening to use nuclear weapons is illegal under international law. And so that was 20 years ago. And some of the good news is that the Hibakusha, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and their allies for decades now have worked hard to abolish nuclear weapons. And I just attended a Hiroshima commemoration in Baltimore on August 6th. And the good news that day was that the Baltimore City Council unanimously passed a resolution in support of the Back from the Brink campaign, which is spreading now. Tacoma Park, Maryland was the first town in the country. Baltimore is the biggest city in the country thus far. And I just learned that the vast majority of Japanese cities have already endorsed Back from the Brink. And this is to support the International Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons that's been underway for a year and has several other major calls. Like no one person should be able to start a nuclear war, like the U.S. president, to do away with that.
We're talking with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and learn about the work of the group by going to their website, beyondnuclear.org. We talk to Kevin every Wednesday in this segment about mainly about nuclear energy and the nuclear industry. But today, because it's the anniversary, tomorrow will be the anniversary of the destruction of Nagasaki, Japan, August 9th, 1945. 6 days before Japan unconditionally surrendered at the end of that ended World War II. And because it's just days after the bombing of Hiroshima that preceded the Nagasaki bombing, we're focused on nuclear weapons in this particular episode. Kevin, I'm just looking around, poking around again about the documents, about what the U.S. government actually decided to do at the end of the Korean War. I want to go back to it because I just looked at it. The archives brought out what had been secret, top secret, classified documents from the end of the Korean War. I'm looking at a New York Times archive from 1984. I want to read a couple paragraphs real quick because, again, this is the Times. It would seem to me to be like such a big story and something at this time every year when we're commemorating or remembering or thinking about or should be what it meant to drop nuclear bombs on human beings in 1945. You would think we would revisit this even from a historical or educational point of view. Here's what it said. Documents released today give details on a decision by President Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1953 to use atomic bombs in North Korea and Communist China if necessary to end the Korean War. Once the armistice was achieved on July 27, 1953, the Eisenhower administration continued to define plans to use nuclear weapons if the Communists renewed the war, which the North Koreans started in 1950. Disputable, but this is the New York Times. Third paragraph. President Eisenhower took office in January 1953 after talks for a ceasefire had dragged on for 2 years and the war had settled into a standoff. The fact that the Eisenhower administration was ready to use nuclear weapons is not new. President Eisenhower, in his memoirs, said he came into office prepared to use them if necessary to break the deadlock. What is new in the 2,000 pages of documents now made public is the high level of planning and the detail of discussion on possible use of these weapons and Mr. Eisenhower's interest in overcoming reluctance to use them. Now, that's kind of interesting because we think historically of Eisenhower as sort of because of his last inaugural address, January 1961, where he warned about the dangers of a emerging military-industrial complex, which he at that time in his first draft called the Military-Industrial-Congressional Complex. We think of Eisenhower kind of as, like, even though he's a general, some sort of a peacenik in contrast with other Americans. But here, it's just exactly what Donald Trump was saying at the beginning of his campaign. If we have all these nuclear weapons, why can't we use them? He wanted to overcome the reluctance to use them.
It was too bad because, as I mentioned in Al Perowitz's book, Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, when the atomic bombings happened, did not like it. He said, I was not trained to fight war this way. But apparently, give it some years, and he started to think differently.
Maybe he had to become president of Columbia University first before he would overcome his reluctance to use nuclear
weapons. But he never showed up for that job, according to the latest biography. He took the title, never bothered to show up for the job.
Well, I think the Republicans were grooming him.
Yes.
They didn't want to have a general become the president. So they wanted the president to be the president of a university. So he needed to do that 1 year stint or something.
That's right.
And another data point from that same time period in the Eisenhower administration was the French colonialists were losing at Dien Bien Phu and were under siege. And the Eisenhower administration offered them atomic weapons to fight back and they refused.
Yeah, that's true. That was 1954. And they did lose at Dien Bien Phu. And that was the end of French colonialism. Eisenhower wanted to use nuclear weapons, but absent the French's willingness to use them, what did the United States government under Eisenhower do? It came to the rescue. It sent the cavalry instead.
That's right.
That's why we had the Vietnam War 7 years later.
The long nightmare in Vietnam began.
And Ellsberg's revelations, like in his book, The Doomsday Machine, he went to work studying the casualty counts to be expected in a nuclear war because he was working in the White House of Eisenhower and in the Pentagon. And the question was asked by some higher up, what would the casualties be? Nobody supposedly looked at it. They had looked at it. They'd kept it secret. And what Ellsberg found was that in a nuclear exchange between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, that China got thrown in just for good measure. Like, even if the Chinese weren't involved, the U.S. was going to attack China with nuclear weapons. And the estimates from the late 1950s that Ellsberg gave to the White House and the Pentagon back, they already knew this, was 600 million deaths in the initial exchange.
Yeah, and that's before the radioactive dust creates the nuclear winter where people just don't have access to that which they need to sustain life.
In the mid to late 1970s, scientists like Carl Sagan and others before him started to realize this phenomenon of nuclear winter, which would be the ultimate consequence. And now we know, thanks to the work of folks like Ira Helfand at International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, that even 100 Nagasaki-sized bombs exchanged between India and Pakistan, with all those cities on fire, would cause a nuclear winter, and up to 2 billion people would starve to death.
When Richard Nixon came into office in January 1969, he said he had a special plan to end the war in Vietnam, which was news to everybody, because the special plan could be like to leave Vietnam, which is what eventually happened in 1973 when the U.S. did leave. Was the United States contemplating using nuclear weapons under Nixon, or were they threatening to do that?
Yes. In Gershon's book, there are several instances documented, and Ellsberg again has revealed that one of the protests at the White House against the Vietnam War likely dissuaded Nixon from dropping an atomic bomb in Vietnam. I think it was at the Enola Gay's unveiling at Dulles that Ellsberg told that story. He was trying to tell people, your work, your activism matters. We may have prevented a nuclear war.
I think I was at that demonstration. There were two moratoriums. It was 1969. There had been nothing like it before. Hundreds of thousands of people came here to Washington, D.C. I was actually organizing buses to come from Rochester, New York, and I was like a young teenager. And there were maybe two or three busloads of people. And then there was like New York Times and other media were starting to make a big deal out of the fact that Nixon had this secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. And people thought, oh, he's going to drop nuclear bombs on Vietnam. And within a week, our bus total from Rochester, New York, this mid-sized city, went from 3 buses to 25 buses. We didn't know how to actually organize all that. But nonetheless, I think it was a turning point in American history, actually, to have this. I mean, nowadays, we're used to big marches. We weren't really used to big marches back then.
Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts, who's a sponsor of the bill that would prevent a U.S. president from first strike using nuclear weapons, has called for a redo of the Central Park rally in the early 1980s, where more than 1 million people came out against the nuclear arms race. He says it's time to do that again.
That was August 12th, 1982, John. August 12th, where were you?
August 12th, 1982, I was packing to move to Washington to start college a week later.
Well, but Kevin Camps is right. There were 1 million people in Central Park, and every politician, even right-wing conservative politicians like the mayor, Ed Koch, wanted to be there and speak because it was so big. And also, that was at the time of a global anti-war movement because people, global anti-nuclear war movement, because people thought Ronald Reagan was going to use nuclear weapons against the Soviet Union. 30 seconds left.
And Ed Markey, to his credit, was the only politician allowed to speak that day because he'd already been leading at the federal level the anti-nuclear weapons and
anti-freeze movement.
Yeah. And he's still at it to this day. He's a co-sponsor of that bill to prevent the U.S. president from first strike using atomic weapons.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Kevin Camps, as we are every Wednesday in this segment called Beyond Nuclear. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to the website beyondnuclear.org. Read about what they're doing. Read Kevin's work. But most importantly, as we always say, get involved, sign up, and show your support for the work of beyondnuclear.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.